Hi everyone, welcome to our webinar for the American Herbalist Guild this evening. Mimi Hernandez is our presenter, and she's a fabulous teacher and the executive director of the American Herbalist Guild. So we're really looking forward to hearing what she has to say. So take it away, Mimi. It's all yours.
Thank you, Stephen, and I do want to thank Stephen Horn for being one of our volunteers who helps coordinate these webinars, and we hope to see many more webinars in the future. I have a little bit to say about that, but first I want to introduce you to the American Herbalist Guild, where you can, which is a member organization founded in 1989 as a nonprofit educational organization to represent the goals and voices of herbalists specializing in the medicinal use of plants. Our primary goal is to promote a high level of professionalism and education in the study and practice of therapeutic herbalism. Our website for that is www.AmericanHerbalistGuild.com, where members at all levels receive a biannual journal of the American Herbalist Guild in your mailbox, a free subscription to our monthly electronic newsletter, discounts to our annual AHG symposium, free access to all of these professional herbalist training webinars. We have quite an archive built up at this point. We have unlimited online access to past issues of the Journal of the American Herbalist Guild, access to professional liability insurance, unlimited online access to hundreds of recorded lectures from AHG Symposia, discounts from many herbal suppliers, companies, and schools, free event and course listings on our online events calendar, free listing for your books and publications on the AHG website, free membership in your local AHG chapter, a certificate of membership, a copy of the AHG Handbook of Mentoring Guidelines, and voting privileges because we are a membership-based organization. We do have quite a full slate coming up next year for AHG members. Now, some of these, like tonight, are going to be offered free for the public, but many of them are going to be for AHG members only. So this is definitely an incentive for you to consider joining the American Herbalist Guild if you haven't already. You can see that on this list we have some of the most well-known and respected educators in the field of herbal medicine from around the country. So I invite you to take a closer look at the American Herbalist Guild and join, and if you have any questions, just let us know. I am going to get started with my lecture tonight, which is how to prevent cognitive decline and natural strategies for brain health. And I'm going to start off with a few descriptions about dementia and Alzheimer's disease, and then I'm going to transition into some insights about the brain and then how we can best feed and support the brain for a long life of healthy cognition. And so dementia, by the way, is not doesn't always mean that someone has Alzheimer's. Alzheimer's is a cause of up to 50 to 80% of dementia cases, but you can have dementia from other issues, including vitamin B12 deficiency, chronic hypoglycemia, head injuries, liver cirrhosis, and excessive drug use. It is estimated that 5 to 8% of all people suffer from a chronic loss of cognition over the age of 65, I should say, suffer from chronic loss of cognition, usually affecting memory and causing confusion. It is also dementia estimated to affect as many as 50% of people in their 80s. And this is different from natural age-related cognitive decline, which is normal, and we'll see some of this as we progress through these slides as well. And so Alzheimer's disease is actually associated with a degeneration and a death of brain cells and involves a steady progressive loss of both intellectual and social skills. And this is a progressive disease leading to premature death. This disease was first described by neuropathologist Alois Alzheimer in 1906, and it is most often diagnosed in people over 65 years of age, although more and more we're seeing more prevalent early onset Alzheimer's, which occurs much earlier. And Alzheimer's disease does affect 5.4 million Americans. 1 in 8 people age 65 and over will be afflicted with Alzheimer's disease. It does at this point rank as the 6th leading cause of death in the United States. 1 in 3 seniors dies with Alzheimer's or another type of dementia. What I think is really interesting is that between 2000 and 2010, Alzheimer's disease increased 68%, while deaths from other major diseases, including heart disease, decreased, as you can see by this chart. So there's definitely something going on here that is affecting the brain of our population, and hopefully we can gain further insight into this as our hour progresses. Early warning signs of Alzheimer's disease include the common symptoms of memory loss, things like mood swings, impaired judgment, especially with things like money and obligations and responsibilities, difficulty with familiar tasks, more progressed would be like difficulty getting dressed or finding your way to routine places that you would often go to, misplacing things, wandering, and confusion. So let's talk a little bit about the brain. The brain is the most powerful organ, yet weighs only about 3 pounds. It does have a very jelly-like, firm texture. There's over 100,000 chemical reactions happening in the human brain every second. And the brain is a neuronal highway where information travels as fast as 268 miles an hour. Information travels to the brain at different speeds because neurons are built differently. And one of the most important aspects of the brain is its blood flow. In fact, the brain, if you can notice in this diagram, the brain has this intricate system of blood flow, which actually is not only used to deliver fuel in the form, mostly in the form of glucose, but sometimes also in the form of ketones, which we'll talk about later, but also oxygen is carried by the blood into the brain through this vascular network that actually helps cool the brain down. It's kind of like also a coolant. There's a lot of electrical activity in the brain, and so this vast blood flow is cooling the brain from overheating. What I think is incredibly interesting is that arteries carry about up to 25% of each of your heartbeat. The blood flow is directed towards your brain, and the brain uses about 20% of the oxygen carried by the blood and up to 50% of the fuel and oxygen carried by the blood when you're thinking hard. So thinking really does require a lot of energy and a lot of oxygen. And so this is the river of life that delivers nutrients to the brain, and not only delivers nutrients to the brain, but also removes toxins. There is an ability for the brain to build up toxins, and the body has processes and can be supported in its natural detoxification of this buildup. 400 miles of capillaries in the brain with a surface area of 100 square feet. And so this is paramount, not just the health of the blood, the ability of blood flow to travel into the brain, but the health of the vessel walls is paramount to proper brain function. And we know that the brain is an intricate electrical neuronal forest. An adult brain contains about 100 billion nerve cells or neurons with branches that connect at more than 100 trillion points. Signals travel through this neuron forest. They form the basis of memories, thoughts, and feelings. And neurons are the chief type of cell that's destroyed by Alzheimer's disease. The brain, as we know, is the center of communication. Signals that form memories and thoughts move through these individual nerve cells as a tiny electrical charge. And they connect, nerve cells connect to one another at synapses, which are locations of communication, where tiny bursts of neurotransmitter signals travel across the synapse, carrying signals to other cells. Now, we've identified dozens of neurotransmitters, and we also know that Alzheimer's disease disrupts both the way electrical charges travel within the cells and the activity of neurotransmitters. And so one of the things that we're going to look at is how healthy the communication exchange is set up in the synapses, because a lot of cognitive decline, dementia, and Alzheimer's is due to poor communication within these synapses, for the electrical impulses and the messages not have impeded ability to travel onto the next cell, thus disrupting the communication pathways. Alzheimer's disease leads to nerve cell death and tissue loss throughout the brain. Over time, the brain shrinks dramatically, affecting nearly all of its functions. And here you can see the difference between a healthy brain and a brain with advanced Alzheimer's. Now, our brain does tend to, has the ability to shrink and grow throughout life, believe it or not. In fact, during pregnancy, a woman who's not sustained appropriately with omega-3 oils and healthy fats might have the tendency for a little bit of brain shrinkage, but the body can and the brain can respond healthily to healthy fats and healthy foods. We have also tangles, and I'm just trying to introduce some concepts here so that when we talk about the remedies and the healthy foods, that you'll have this in your you'll have this in the right context as far as some background vocabulary. But tangles is a concept that comes up a lot in Alzheimer's research, and this is the tangles refer to these abnormal clusters of protein fragments that build up between nerve cells, and we refer to those as plaques. And so dead and dying nerve cells contain these tangles, which are made up of twisted strands of proteins, thus also impeding healthy communication in the brain. We also have beta amyloid, which is another buzzword in Alzheimer's research. And plaques have to do with beta amyloids, because they form when protein pieces of beta amyloid clump together. These beta amyloids come from a larger protein found in fatty membranes surrounding the nerve cells. These are chemically sticky and gradually build up into plaque. These clumps block cell-to-cell signaling at the synapses, and they also, in addition, activate immune system response that may trigger inflammation in the brain and in the body. So let's talk a little bit about brain food, because this is going to be probably our most significant health-building attribute of supporting the brain comes from what we feed ourselves and what our brain is made out of. And about two-thirds of the brain is composed of fats. In fact, the membranes, the working surface of the brain, is made from fatty acids. And the myelin sheath, the protective sheath that covers communicating neurons and all the nerves in your body, is composed of 30% protein and 70% fat. So the question is, what fats are you eating? Because that's what your brain is made of. So are you eating healthy coconut oils and fish oils, and or are you eating things like Crisco and fried chicken? Because the fats you eat will be the fats that compose your brain. And the different nature of these fats have everything to do with your brain's ability to function and communicate and energize. So essential fatty acids are the most important category that we'll be looking at, because essential fatty acids are essential building materials, and these are fatty acids that we need to get from our diet. And brains, and so essential fatty acids, you may have heard before, this is what we call the omega-3 fatty acids, are the ones that make it really easy for signals to cross the gap between brain cells. Brain cells need a degree of flexibility to function properly, and this is accomplished by maintaining a balance of the different types of fatty acids in the cell membrane. DHA is one of those essential fatty acids and the most abundant fat in the brain. And so this becomes very important, not only throughout life and into as we age, but also very important during pregnancy for women and for the fetus to get adequate amounts of DHA for future brain health. In fact, the fetus prefers DHA in so many quantities that it actually will leach DHA from a mother's brain, hence the brain ability for the brain to shrink and grow as in response to our diet. So DHA is also a very common compound in mother's milk, and so very important for our mothers and elders to consume adequate amount, and children, babies, to consume an adequate amount of DHA. Loss in DHA concentrations in brain cell membranes does correlate to a decline in structural and functional integrity of this tissue. And as we age, oxidative damage, which I'm going to explain later, that comes with age also causes a decline in membrane DHA concentrations, and with it, cognitive impairment. So we do know that DHA comes from fish oil, from fish as well, and from some grass-fed and free-range animals, like grass-fed beef and free-range chickens and eggs. And we can also find DHA in supplements over the counter as well. And then we also have brain blockers. So French researchers have found that dietary trans fatty acids also indeed find their way into the myelin of brain cells, where they change the electrical conductivity of those cells. Trans fats replace the natural DHA in our membranes, and they affect electrical activity of the neuron and disrupt communication. And furthermore, when diets are deficient in those healthy omega-3 acids, fatty acids, then the incorporation of trans fats was apparently doubled. And so this is one way to look at it. Essential fatty acids in the omega-3s are composed, our oil, compounds in the oil are very, very flexible, and they're also, they have like a curvy shape to them, as opposed to the shape of some of the omega-6s and the shape of some of the trans fats, which have a very firm, straight, lined edge to them. And so if the membranes of your brain cells are made from these fats, well, if you line up a bunch of trans fats together and put them very close to each other with their straight edges, what happens is that you're going to have cells that have very little fluidity or flexibility for communication. There's no gaps for communication to happen, for communication out or for communication in. And I mean not just biological communication or nutritional communication, but also I mean metaphysical communication, the entry of light itself. And so when we look at it in terms of omega-3 oils that have that kind of curvy shape to them, you can almost envision, like this came up when I was at the women's conference where I first did this class. This was an advanced class at the women's conference. I had this vision when all these women were standing in a circle formation, kind of like at an opening circle, and I thought about the omega-3s with all their curvy lines and the fact that there's all these spaces for communication to come in if all these women are standing side by side and they have natural curves. And so it's just it's kind of a communication analogy that I pointed out because I happened to be at a women's conference, but it's the difference between consuming omega-3s and consuming trans fats is incredibly life-damaging to have processed foods with high trans fats in the diet. And so this refers not just to it refers to partially hydrogenated oils, which we really need to take the time to read our labels. Now, the FDA did recently, I mean, this is so well known at this point that the FDA actually has declared trans fats as unhealthy and is now initiating the steps to remove trans fats from foods processed in America, which is a really, it's about time kind of move as far as I'm concerned. But we still need to be very conscious about what kind of fats we're intaking. And I really believe that the surge of Alzheimer's disease in our elder population has everything to do, has a lot to do with the wave of trans fats that has come through our food supply system. And so of course there's other things like stress and our pace of life and pollution and things like that that were different. Our diet has definitely changed since Paleolithic times, and one of them, another influence we're going to see is the lack of antioxidants in today's diet, which we'll take a look at here in a little bit as well. And so with regard to omega-3s and omega-6s, so your omega-6, probably the most common is corn, right? Corn oil, these are, and even just like regular vegetable oil, these are not the most healthy oils to have in your diet. So when I work with clients, one of the first things I'm going to ask is what kind of oils are in your diet. And by the way, a lot of people are now moving toward olive oil, which is definitely a healthier option. Olive oil actually is an omega-9, so it doesn't fall in this whole ratio. But the omega-3s are going to be primarily your fish oils and your healthy nuts and things like this. Western diets tend to have at least 20 times more omega-6 fats than omega-3 fats, which is a very unhealthy ratio of 20 to 1, when the most optimal healthy ratio is actually 1 to 1. And so since this lecture was designed to be more to an advanced audience, I really encourage you to do your own research about omega-3 versus omega-6 fats. One of my favorite resources for this is a book called Healthy Fats. I encourage you to go and do some of that background research. But in the way of omega-3 fats, low blood levels of omega-3s are also associated with brain shrinkage, mild memory loss, declines in cognitive function, and a higher risk of developing Alzheimer's disease and other forms of dementia. So just in conclusion, the lower the omega-3s, the poorer the performance, according to lead author and Alzheimer's researcher at University of California in LA. We can eat these healthy foods with omega-3s, but it's also, I think, important to supplement with fish oil for many people, including vegetarians who might be adverse to eating fish. I think, and I've worked with a lot of vegetarians or vegans who will make that exception in an effort to get their omega-3s. And there are vegetarian sources of omega-3s out there, like hemp seed oil, flax seed and flaxseed oil. These are all healthy vegetarian ways of getting omega-3s. However, if the body is already in a state of inflammation or chronic disease, these oils in flax and hemp and other vegetarian sources of omega-3s aren't able to go through the conversion into DHA. Because the omega-3s are present as ALA oils, ALA fatty acids, which once in the body need to be converted by an enzyme called delta-6 desaturase to become DHA and EPA, which are anti-inflammatory, structurally important fatty acids. When the body has already experienced a fair degree of inflammatory process and chronic illness, autoimmune disease, and alcoholism and addiction, different things like that, our body becomes less inclined to make that conversion because delta-6 desaturase is not as functionally available. For many people, unless they're already relatively healthy and balanced, I really urge people to go straight toward the fish oil because the fish oil actually has DHA and EPA in it. And so your body doesn't need to take the extra step toward conversion of those fatty acids. In the journal Neurology in February, researchers showed that high blood levels of omega-3s are associated with bigger brain volumes, better performance on tests of visual memory and abstract reasoning, and lower blood levels of beta amyloid. A Dutch study of cognitive function in males aged 69 through 89 suggests that a high intake of omega-6 fatty acids is positively associated with cognitive impairment. So the higher the omega-6, the higher the cognitive impairment. And high fish consumption, hence your omega-3s, is inversely associated with cognitive impairment. So the higher fish consumption, the lower cognitive impairment. In fact, there's been some studies that have researched the progression of early modern humans and the brain power that we've evolved into. And some of the conclusions out there are that seafood has played a role in our coevolution of boosting brains of early humans, according to the proceedings of the Natural Academy of Science. The National Academy of Science, the theory is that DHA from seafood boosted the brain power of early humans. And Stephen Cunani, the professor of nutrition at University of Toronto, is quoted in saying, you don't need a big brain to collect mussels and clams, but living on them gives you the excess energy and nutrients that can be directed toward brain growth. When, back to the baby in utero, there's a lot of studies indicating that babies who get adequate nutrition in the way of DHA and omega-3 fatty acids have better cognition even late into life, have better memory, have better eyesight, have better ability to process math and have just a healthy cognition as opposed to babies that don't get the DHA. And again, I can't stress enough, the mother really needs to have adequate intake of DHA herself. Because it's very common for a mother who's depleted to have things like brain fog and postpartum depression and that kind of the, just not feeling like on top of it. And so a lot of that has to do with DHA. And there are baby formulas that make that have DHA in them. In fact, in some countries, it's mandatory to put DHA in baby formula. But not in this country. So it's a little higher price baby formula, but it's a huge, it really is a huge influence in the development of that child. Another most common fatty acid in the myelin is oleic acid, which also happens to be a most abundant fatty acid in human milk and in our diet. And oleic acid is found in extra virgin olive oil. Senior citizens who consume extra virgin olive oil as their main dietary fat were less likely to experience age-related cognitive decline compared with people who ate less monounsaturated fats. Monounsaturated oleic acid is the main component of olive oil, as well as other healthy nuts like almonds, pecans, macadamia nuts, peanuts, and avocados. And so we also have seen in research that extra virgin olive oil prevents the abnormal brain tangle formation. There's that buzzword, tangle. And also oleocanthal, which is present in olive oil, boosts production of enzymes that decrease the accumulation of beta amyloid. Oleocanthal is associated with the consumption of, and oleic acid are associated with the consumption of the Mediterranean diet, which is very high in fish and fresh produce and whole grains and olives and olive oil and relatively low in desserts and trans fats and other of the more harmful, the fats that the Mediterranean diet seems to revolve around are fats that come from seafood and fish and lean meats and fats that come from olive oil and nuts. And so there's a lot of research on the Mediterranean diet in boosting cognition, but also in preventing heart disease as well. Vitamin E is also very important in the protection of nerve cell neurons. It's a very potent antioxidant. We need antioxidants that are that are fat soluble because there's so much fatty tissue in the brain and in the nerves. So a lot of our antioxidants tend to be water soluble, but vitamin E is one of those that it easily gets into our fatty tissue. People with Alzheimer's and mild cognitive impairment had lower blood levels of total tocopherols and total tocotrienols and total vitamin E. Research has suggested that vitamin E prevents the oxidative damage. Again, there's that word, oxidative damage. We're going to get to this when we talk about antioxidants. The beta amyloid induces oxidative damage and delays memory deficits in animal models. A placebo-controlled clinical trial of vitamin E in patients with moderately advanced Alzheimer's disease was conducted and showed that subjects in the vitamin E group that were treated with 2,000 IU of alpha tocopherol equivalents indicated that vitamin E may slow functional deterioration, leading to nursing home placement. Another healthy fat that I want to point out is coconut oil. I took this picture in Costa Rica because I was so intrigued by the white matter inside the coconut. And much like walnuts, coconuts have this what herbalists refer to as the doctrine of the signatures, which tells us that plants have these indicators, these visible cues that they show us teach us how best to use. It's meant to show you that in the walnut. Everyone knows that walnuts look like brains. I think the coconut is a great representation of like the head and the skull and the brainy, the firmy jelly-like substance of the brain. The coconut oil is a different type of fatty acid. It has medium-chain fatty acids, and these medium-chain fatty acids are very quickly consumed by the body as fuel. And then they're converted to ketones. And so ketones have also shown to be a significant source of fuel for the brain beyond glucose. The brain does, but it can also use ketones as fuel as an alternative. In fact, some diets, I was just talking with Paul Bergner, who's a very well-known herbalist who's done a lot of research into ketogenic diets. Ketogenic diets are diets that are very low in carbs and very low in sugar that focus mainly on protein, fats, and greens and vegetables and fatty acids and produce a mass as fuel. And people who have a lot more clarity and a lot more ability to focus. Coconut oil is one of those oils that should be kind of an everyday oil in your kitchen. A while back, there were a series of studies on coconut oil that were incredibly negative. You might remember these, but basically it was saying that heart disease and I think, you know, this is like bad for everyone. Modern researchers reopened those studies, they found out that those studies were all being done on partially hydrogenated coconut or medium chain fatty acids. Those are now going to be coconut.
Mimi, just excuse me a second. Yes. Your sound is cutting in and out, and just to make sure your headset is plugged in securely, it could be the internet, but in case it's not, just make sure you're...
All right.
Okay.
I am... I'm all hooked up.
Yeah. It's just that there's a little bit of fuzz coming in, and it may be the internet. But I just wanted to make sure that it wasn't like a loose connection on your headset or something. Okay? You still there? Whoops.
Can you hear me?
I can hear you,
Can you hear me now?
Yeah, you just faded out for a second.
Okay.
So
back to that slide.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I did. I just changed. I actually just changed the internet I was logged into. Because I have two options here at the office, and one of them tends to be better than the other. So.
Okay, great.
Can I move on? All right, thanks. I'm sorry that if that disrupted anyone's ability to tune in. But I was on the topic of coconut oil and what a healthy source of fuel that can be for the brain, because these medium-chain fatty acids convert to ketones in the body, and the ketones are an alternative fuel source for the brain that really lead to an activation of focus and clarity in the brain as well. So let's move on from oil and probably one of the most significant things you can do to boost your brain health and to keep your brain very in a state of focus and energy is to consume more berries, blueberries in particular, and strawberries and other blackberries, just all your foods of color, especially cherries, dark cherries, raspberries, all these, even like pomegranates. Now, not all of these are botanically berries, but I'm referring to dark berries as we know them in the grocery store and other foods of color that have these blues and red colors in them. But most of the studies have been done on blueberries, what we're learning about blueberries is that they help protect the brain from oxidative stress and may reduce the effects of age-related conditions such as Alzheimer's disease or dementia. Among women who consume two or more servings of strawberries and blueberries each week, we saw a modest reduction in memory decline, according to Harvard researchers. A high intake of flavonoid-rich berries such as strawberries and blueberries over time can delay memory decline in older women by 2.5 years, according to the Journal of the American Neurological Association. Specifically, researchers found that the berry consumption was also linked with increased autophagy, which is the natural process that the brain undergoes to clear out accumulation of those toxic proteins. Now, we can call the blueberry the brain berry, according to James Joseph, lead scientist in the Laboratory of Neuroscience at the USDA Human Nutrition Research Center on Aging. Dopamine levels were much higher when the brain was under the influence of berries, dopamine being a neurotransmitter that enables smooth, controlled movements, efficient memory, attention, and problem-solving function. Dr. Joseph speculated that blueberry extract might also increase brain cell membrane fluidity. Remember how important that is and why the omega-3s were so important, because they have those curvy fluid shapes, while reducing levels of inflammatory compounds, thus slowing the brain's normal aging process. And so one of the things with these berries, raspberries, blueberries, blackberries, even things like pomegranate juice and dark grapes, red wine, are that they are very high in polyphenols. And polyphenols tend to be antioxidant and anti-inflammatory. These are our foods of color. Now, antioxidants is kind of a buzzword today in the marketplace and in our perception of our health. Everyone says eat more antioxidants. But very few people understand what antioxidants really are. And so, I'm just here to tell you, antioxidants, these polyphenols, are prevalent in these foods of color, especially our blues and our reds, and even our yellows, like turmeric, for instance. Now a lot of people wonder, why are antioxidants so important? Well, the reason antioxidants are so important is because they neutralize and immobilize free radicals. So here we go, another buzzword in today's marketplace and perception of health. So what are free radicals? Well, obviously free radicals are these things that do damage to our body, and they are. Free radicals are these incomplete, unsatisfied compounds that are very needy and grabby. And so when they circulate through the body, they grab things, primarily electrons, because free radicals are missing electrons from their outer valence shell. And so they need those electrons to stabilize themselves. And so they travel through our body looking, scavenging electrons from our own tissue. Where do we get free radicals? Well, free radicals comes out of our metabolic pipe, our kind of our tailpipe. The more we metabolize, the more free radicals we release. And so free radicals are a natural process of life, although naturally in life we've been inclined to eat foods of color, which is something that's missing in a lot of today's diets. In fact, if you look at today's dinner plate, we have exposure to far less color than we used to paleolithically. And so it's very important to get this color. We also get free radicals from pollution, from things like smoking or anything that you breathe into the lungs that is not just healthy fresh air. Stress and fear, believe it or not, cause an enormous amount of free radical production. We also get free radicals from trans fats. That's no surprise. We get free radicals from overexposure to the sun and radiation. And so, in fact, exposure to the sun is a good way to demonstrate the power of free radicals. As we have free radical exposure from the sun, you can actually see the burn. You can see the burn of these free radicals going around and scavenging electrons from your own tissue to the point of your tissues inflamed, and you can see that. But this is why antioxidants like green tea, blueberries, lycopene and tomatoes are so, and coconut oil and palm oil are so effective at preventing and addressing sunburn. If you want to have like an analogy here, and you probably heard this analogy if you've taken any of my classes, but my son, for instance, I have a little 9-year-old boy, and he is a free radical. His name is Evan, and at school they have a lot of issues with him because he's a sensory seeker, and so he's kind of unsatisfied just walking in a straight line. He's very grabby. He has to touch everything. As a sensory seeker, he has to touch the perimeter of every room, and he has to touch people. And so if he's walking in a single file line at school, he's this free radical. It's very grabby. He's grabbing ponytails. He's grabbing pictures off the wall. He's grabbing the kid's pocket behind him. He's, just has his hands, just can't study. And so his teacher had this brilliant suggestion, and she said, "Look, Evan, from now on, you are going to be, you're in charge of carrying this heavy box of art supplies." And so then all of a sudden, Evan's standing a single file line, but his hands are kind of tied up and satisfied, and he can't be that grabby free radical. And so the analogy I'm pointing to is that foods of color are the antioxidant that bind the hands of the antioxidants so that those antioxidants aren't unraveling our tissue and changing the nature of our DNA, because we also know that free radicals are so tiny that they can actually get into the DNA and cause a functional change in the DNA, which then leads to cancer. Back to that sunburn analogy, that's how we get skin cancers and things like this. And so because as we age, we have so much exposure over a lifetime to free radicals, as we age, we're prevalent to inflammation, to these chronic inflammatory issues, to the unraveling of our tissue and our brain matter. And so one of the biggest strategies that you can make, not only for your cognition, but just for your quality of life and the quantity of life, is to eat berries every day. And so in my clinic, in my clinical practice, on every protocol that I write for anyone, you have a prescription for a quarter cup of berries a day. And so berries every day, paprika sprinkled on all your food, green tea on the regular, red wine occasionally, dark chocolate fits this scenario also, foods of color all throughout your day, dark fruit juices, dark sugar-free, apple juice-free juice basis. So I'm talking 100% pomegranate juice, 100% blueberry juice, 100% black cherry juice. One of the most important things you can do for the elders and for children who are facing things like ADHD or ADD, one of the most important things is to make sure those children get their OPCs, their oligomeric proanthocyanidins, which are those blue colors in our foods and in our fruits. And so that's probably one of the most significant changes we can make to our lifestyle is to make sure that we are getting plenty of foods of color. Researchers have found that a large helping of blueberries boost concentration and memory up to 5 hours later. So the shift is prevalent, is apparent very soon. In tests, volunteers who drank a blueberry smoothie in the morning and in the mid-afternoon. British scientists who made the discovery believe that antioxidants in blueberries also stimulate the flow of blood and oxygen to the brain. So we're not just antioxidant, we're also stimulating blood flow. All these blue colors in the blueberries have the ability to maintain our elastin in our connective tissue, in our blood vessels and muscles. And so we have healthier membranes, not just in our blood vessels, but in our skin and in all our other tissue in our body. These antioxidant compounds are found to cross the blood-brain barrier, which means that they indeed have an impact on the brain, and they're antioxidant, which equals anti-inflammatory. So let's also talk about herbal support, because I'm an herbalist, and so I want to just jump right into some herbs that would also – I also believe that you can't make a long-term impact without addressing first what you're eating every day and what your body is exposed to on a daily basis or not. And so the first herb I do want to talk about is ginkgo biloba. In fact, ginkgo biloba gives us a long history. It's a primitive order of plants dating 200 million years old. So this is very much the elder of the plant world. And part of the reason it's withstood this kind of longevity is because it's had the ability to withstand insects, disease, and pollution due to its unique mix of pharmacologically active compounds in its leaves. Elderly patients with chronic cerebral insufficiency demonstrated a significant regression of major symptoms from things like vertigo, tinnitus, headaches, short-term memory, vigilance, and mood changes. Ginkgo biloba was seen to have a positive effect on those parameters. From many different strategic perspectives, ginkgo biloba can be very supportive for the brain because it has been shown to improve glucose and ATP utilization within the brain. We see that the brain has more access to energy under the influence of ginkgo biloba, but the brain also has more access to blood flow, which we see with ginkgo biloba increasing blood flow to the brain. We also see an improvement of brain communication because we've seen that ginkgo improves the transmission of nerve impulses and increases alertness by increasing the brain's alpha wave rhythms and decreasing theta rhythms. And so really important things here. By the way, it should be stated that while I'm talking about ginkgo biloba, all the research has been done actually on an extract of ginkgo biloba that we can parallel conclusions off just the leaf, but not based on research. And so this is ginkgo biloba extract that we're talking about. This is what is sold in supplement form as a standardized extract. Ginkgo products are standardized to contain 24% bioflavonoids, and so this is what all the research has been done on with regard to ginkgo biloba and brain health. So an appropriate dose might be 120 to 240 milligrams daily of ginkgo biloba leaf extract. I like to advise people to take it in 2 to 3 doses throughout the day, and then this is kind of a long-term effect that we see from ginkgo. By the way, at one point, ginkgo biloba extract was the number one selling herbal supplement in Europe, and one of my teachers and mentors, Simon Mill, who was the president of the British Herbal Association taught me that everyone over 40 should take Ginkgo biloba extract, and that was his professional opinion. Lemon balm, I think, is one of the most wonderful herbs and useful herbs to have around. It's characterized by square stems, opposite leaves, and a beautiful aroma. Lemon balm is very easy to grow in a container garden in a piece of landscape. In fact, it's so easy to grow, some people might want to take some measures to keep it contained. I don't think anyone should ever have to buy lemon balm, because if you know someone with lemon balm, you can get the little starter very easily. But lemon balm has most noted in herbal medicine for not only children, but also elders. Because it's calming, it's relaxing, it's what we would consider unnerving, it's very gentle and relaxing to the stomach and to the digestion. It helps people sleep better. It has this really uplifting effect on the mood that can sometimes be seen as an antidepressant, but it really kind of clears the cobwebs from the brain and is said to really enhance our outlook. And so it kind of pulls you from, you know, out of a very negative space and into a very light and wonderful space. And is very easily available. A lot of people haven't realized that lemon balm's been involved in a lot of studies affecting the brain. 600 milligrams of Melissa, which is our genus here, Melissa officinalis, ameliorated the negative mood effects of lab-induced stress, with significantly increased ratings of self-calmness and reduced ratings of alertness. And so it really helps calm that stress and puts us in a parasympathetic space, which then is really good for brain health. In addition, a significant increase in the speed of mathematical processing with no reduction in accuracy was observed after ingestion of a 300 milligram dose. A 1,600 milligram dose of dried leaf of lemon balm, so we're talking maybe two large capsules of dried leaf. And by the way, we don't dry capsules of lemon balm. Lemon balm makes such a lovely tea that this can be something that just becomes the house tea for any family. A 1,600 milligram dose of dried leaf improved cognitive performance, timed memory task performance, and rapid visual information processing tasks, while inducing calmness, improving the mood, lengthening the attention span. Effects were seen within an hour after one single dose. And so the conclusion of this study was that these results suggest that doses of Melissa officinalis at or above the maximum employed here can improve cognitive performance and mood and may therefore be a valuable adjunct in the treatment of Alzheimer's disease. Lemon balm in a double-blind trial, supplementation with an extract of lemon balm for 16 weeks significantly improved reduced agitation compared with the placebo in people with Alzheimer's disease. The amount lemon balm used here was 60 drops per day of a 1-to-1 tincture. That would translate into maybe a teaspoon a day of a 1-to-5 tincture, which would be maybe 5. You know, if you're 60 drops, that might be 2 mils, so I can't do math when I'm teaching, but we can do the math later. A double, and this is based on a trial that was published in the Journal of Neurology and Neurosurgical Psychiatry. Also, you know, I actually use lemon balm for my son for his issues with attention span, focus, and hyperness. Which his teachers really appreciate that the formula that I use for him. So it's very safe, and he even asked for it because he knows his own triggers, and he knows when he's getting a little when he's getting set off in a direction, and he'll ask for it even. So, but the reason that lemon balm, one of the reasons lemon balm's having such an effect here is because it's displaying cholinergic binding activity and in acetylcholinesterase inhibition. And so this is basically, here we're talking about another neurotransmitter that's necessary for cognition. This is acetylcholine. And as we age, acetylcholinesterase, which is an enzyme attacks the acetylcholine and the synapses more and more to the point of acetylcholine depletion. And as a result, our cognition declines, and so does our parasympathetic activity. And when we're in parasympathetic activity, we rest and digest better. We have a little bit of enhancement. And so in the 2006 Journal of Ethnopharmacology, researchers conclude that lemon balm is one of the several herbs that may be helpful in the prevention and treatment of Alzheimer's disease due to its ability to inhibit acetylcholinesterase activity and for its antioxidant properties. A lot of pharmaceutical research is for Alzheimer's disease is going in the direction of cholinergic binding activity and acetylcholinesterase inhibitory activity. And so lemon balm constituents have also been found to be effective at reducing the accumulation of the amyloid beta. This antioxidant, it also has antioxidants in and of its own right. So earlier I said that antioxidants are easily found in foods of color, but they're also found to be pronounced in aromatic plants. And so your culinary herbs, your thyme, your sage, your rosemary, your lemon balm are all high in antioxidants. John Evelyn wrote, balm is sovereign for the brain, strengthening the memory and powerfully chasing away melancholy. And he did this at the turn of the century between 1600 and 1700. So we've had this wisdom collectively for quite a long time. Other cholinergic plants that have a reputation for inhibiting acetylcholinesterase would be things like sage and artemisia and rosemary, or other sage and salvia and rosemary being also quite aromatic culinary plants. The Chinese club moss has been studied for its acetylcholinesterase inhibiting activity. In fact, a supplement, huperzine A, has been developed based on Chinese club moss. Also the snowdrop, which contains galathamine, which has also been, this is more of a European plant, has also demonstrated to be acetylcholinesterase inhibiting and have a pronounced effect on cognition. And so the issue with the snowdrop is the availability and hasn't really lent itself to mass production or mass research for that matter. But people working on a folk level with herbs and European a little more background on this plant. And by the way, the bulbs, they don't use the bulbs, they just use the aerial parts of the bulbs, have some toxicity to them. But there is some research if you want to do some follow-up research on galathamine, and it's a very interesting brain awakening activity. And Gotu Kola, also a scientific name, Centella asiatica. And I love this picture too. It's another nice representation of the doctrine of the signature. This to me looks like brains on a spinal column. And so this has a reputation to restore traditional medicine from India. This is a part of our Ayurvedic Indian herbal tradition. Brain and enhancing and anti-aging longevity producing properties. Also very high in B vitamins, which we know is good for brain health and for the nerves. It's also considered a vascular vulnerary and neovascularizer. So a vascular vulnerary means that it can heal tissue damage on the membrane level of the blood vessels. We also use it topically as a vulnerary to heal skin and wounds and things like that. But it's also a neovascularizer, which means that it induces the production of small capillary, new capillaries and new blood vessels as we need them. In fact, I want to read this translation of this very old Ayurvedic text that is just really, really captures the reputation of Gotu Kola in Ayurvedic medicine. Taking the expressed juice of Brahmi as instructed, continuous use for 1 week improves memory, intellect, and imparts a celestial glow to the complexion. Taking for a second week revives old forgotten memories and increases the ability to write books. Continuing to take the juice for a third week allows one to repeat from memory up to 100 words if heard or read in a single sitting. In addition, this continued use for 21 days removes all inauspicious features, whether of the body or of the mind. The goddess of learning appears in an embodied form to the mind of the user, and all kinds of knowledge comes rushing into his memory. A single hearing is enough to make him reproduce verbatim from memory a discourse, however lengthy. And oh, by the way, he's enabled to live for 500 years. So it's just a really beautiful ancient text that really captures this brain-building, cognitive life experience enhancement gifted by Centella. And, you know, we can supplement. Probably one of the most, like, popular ways to take Centella is by juicing it. For those of you who can grow it, I've seen it growing, like, on people's, the floors of their greenhouses and things like that. It likes to have its feet wet. But for others, you know, there's Gotu Kola on the market. Gotu Kola powder, for instance, is something you can put every day in your brain, a berry smoothie. And so supplementation with Gotu Kola in the elderly improved cognitive function and mood, alleviated generalized anxiety disorder, and improved the willingness for adjustment and cognition. And it works in the brain, on the brain tissue. In animal models, we've learned some real interesting ways that it helps boost brain health. For instance, it's shown to increase the dendritic length and dendritic branching points in rats treated with Centella asiatica juice for 6 weeks. A water extract of Gotu Kola and of beta amyloid aggregates in a mouse model disease with high amounts of beta amyloid. And then Centella asiatica also accelerated nerve regeneration with larger caliber axons and greater myelination. So a lot of really promising, interesting physiological conclusions are that were, or not conclusions, but insights that we're coming across here. And another one also from the Ayurvedic tradition would be ashwagandha. Ashwagandha is classified in the Ayurvedic tradition as a rasayan, or a rejuvenating or life-extending agent, and it's considered a building tonic in this tradition of medicine, building strength, building muscle mass, vitality, memory, bone marrow, thyroid, adrenals, desirability. For 5,000 years at least, it's thought to balance life forces during stress and aging, and it's also seen as a promoter of learning and memory retriever. Studies have suggested that ashwagandha extract may reverse memory loss and improve cognitive abilities. In mice, mice given ashwagandha for 20 days, after 30 days of behavior, the mice returned to normal after they had memory loss. And we've also seen in many studies a reduction in amyloid along with a reduction in tangles of nerve fibers, greater acetylcholine receptor activity. And research have also speculated that rather than impacting the brain directly, researchers have found that the herb works by boosting a protein in the liver, which enters the bloodstream and helps clear amyloid from the brain. Ashwagandha is also available on the market. I like to use the ashwagandha powder, bulk powder, which is the way that Ayurveda really uses herbs is in bulk powders, and put a spoonful of it in that berry smoothie every morning is one way to get the ashwagandha powder in. Another one that we might consider for brain health is turmeric. Or curcumin extract, and here I am eating fresh dug turmeric from somewhere close to the Amazon in Zamora near in Ecuador. And what we've learned from curcumin extract, so again, not necessarily bulk turmeric, although there definitely are reliable parallels that we can make between turmeric and curcumin, especially if you add black pepper to your turmeric, you're going to get so much more activity and bioavailability of turmeric's medicine. Turmeric, by the way, is that golden spice that you see in curry or in some Indian dishes, so you can cook with that. But what we see, and it's also available as a standardized extract on the market, and what scientists have seen in a curcumin extract in relation to Alzheimer's disease is decreased beta amyloid plaques, delayed degradation of neurons, metal chelation, anti-inflammatory, antioxidant activity, the decrease of microglia formation, overall memory improvement in patients, and also, like the Gotu Kola, turmeric is well known for its ability to undergo the process of neovascularization. And so one thing that I like to do, and I think this is, we're winding it down here for those of you who are wanting to be done by 8 o'clock. I know it's a few minutes past. I'm down to my very last final slides. I like to make brain balls, and so this right here is this actually here is turmeric nut butter. I take my favorite nut butter, organic, and then combine it with turmeric to have this very wonderfully palatable antioxidant snack every day. And so, but we can expand this to include more things. Like nut butter and coconut oil, just putting it in a big bowl. Like, I don't really tend to measure things anymore because I don't have a product manufacturing business anymore. I now compound for the sake of my family and friends, which makes me very folksy now in my medicine making approach. So what I do is I put some coconut oil and some nut butter in a bowl, and then I sprinkle some ashwagandha powder in there, some turmeric powder, a little black pepper for the turmeric powder, ground flax seeds for our omega-3s, a little Gotu Kola powder, and then I use either honey or like a lemon balm or a rosemary honey to thicken all that up and get the right consistency. And then you would take that and you can just roll it up into balls and put that in the refrigerator. You can roll those balls in chocolate, in coconut flakes, in sesame seeds, and nuts, whatever you want to do. You can be very creative. But having a couple of these every day is going to be one way to get all these kind of brain-boosting herbs into your recipe. And so I wanted to leave you with something that you can maybe play with in the kitchen. And so the last two slides I have are just kind of telling you what I'm doing. I'm going to Costa Rica in February, and there's still space in these trips. In this trip, we're going to do a traditional plant healers tour where we're going to be visiting shamans and members of the Bribri tribe and local herbalists and engage with them on healing plants and healing traditions. This is February 3rd through 10th. We have a good price for this and a couple spots left. This is sponsored by centralash.com. Or .org, I should say. If you enjoy my teaching and would like more of a foundational training, I have a Community Herbalist Foundational Training Certificate coming up. This one is sponsored by One World Healing Community with 8 live sessions from February 11th to April 1st. There's a significant discount if you enroll by January 15th. So you can look for more information at oneworldhealer.com. I also wanted to let you know that I have other free lectures that are out there in the world right now. If you go to the American Herbalist Guild website, you'll find the Herbs for Vascular Support lecture that I did a couple years ago for free. This lecture also on brain health will be posted on the American Herbalist Guild website, so you can access it and if you want. And I'll put the PDF of the slides up there too, so that you can have this for your reference and go through it again. You know, sometimes I teach kind of fast and you might want to go revisit some of this. But I also do the Community Herbalist Foundational Training, the Family Herbalist Certificate, and the Advanced Herbal Science Certificate for One World Healing Community. And I'm also working on an ethnobotany and its relevance to herbal medicine course through the Sylvan Institute of Botanical Medicine. So feel free to check out those resources. I am, again, Mimi Hernandez, registered herbalist with the American Herbalist Guild. If you want more information about my work, you can go to mimihernandez.com. If you want more information about One World Healing, you can go to oneworldhealer.com. And if you want more information about the American Herbalist Guild, AmericanHerbalistGuild.com. Thank you, Stephen, and thank you for all of you who tuned in tonight, and I hope the audio issues weren't too problematic.
Yeah, there was just a little bit of a problem with the internet tonight because occasionally we'd lose a word here or there, but I think we got most of it pretty well. So thank you, Mimi. That was great. And I have to say, I'm going to look forward to making your brain balls because I'll turn 60 this year and I think I can use them. And I'm glad to know that I'm not the only one who doesn't measure very carefully. Because I'm not making stuff commercial either, so it's just kind of like people say, how do you do this? Well, just a little of that, a little of that, you know. Okay. Sort of like cooking. Okay. Got some great questions that people have asked. So the first one is, I have heard caution against taking DHA because of increased cancer risk. I'm wondering what that link is or if there's anything to this caution. Have you heard anything about that?
I think that the smart thing to do there would be to take fish oil by the spoonful on a daily basis, or eat fish regularly. Looking to your fish market provider for there's some fish that's heavy on the mercury. A responsibly and ethically processed fish oil is going to be very low in mercury. But I haven't heard about the DHA cancer connection. I'm not saying that's not out there, but if you want to send me some information about that, I'm saying to move away from is concentrated, encapsulated products I'm not a huge fan of. And so I want to do the fish oil in its natural form and its natural availability through oil and through fish and through food. And so there's going to be a lot of products out there that are going to be ultra-concentrated DHA products, and so I would steer away from those.
Yeah. What about a label that says non-hydrogenated oil in the ingredients?
I hope so. That would defeat the purpose.
Yes. But I think with even then, the omega-6 vegetable oils still aren't that good for you, even if they aren't partially hydrogenated.
Oh, absolutely. There's a difference between vegetable oil and trans fat or partially hydrogenated oils. You can have a vegetable oil that's not hydrogenated yet, but then you can have a vegetable oil, and like I said earlier, even coconut oil or some of our healthier oils can be lab-induced to become partially hydrogenated, and in that case, very inflammatory and very negative for our health.
And I think this question, person saying, what about fermented cod liver oil butter blend that has not only omega-3 but omega-6? Is there a healthy omega-6?
Gosh, that fermented, have you ever tried it?
I haven't, no.
Well, if you can get through that flavor, I think that I cannot do it. I'm sorry. Like, it's just, but I know that it's one of the best ways to get your fish oils through having it fermented, and it's supposed to be really easily assimilated. And I would encourage people to look into taking their fermented fish oil that way, but it didn't work for my family, unfortunately. But what was the other question?
Well, I think the other part of it is, I think, is there a healthy omega-6? And obviously you do need omega-6. It's just most people.
Absolutely. Absolutely. There are healthy omega-6s, for sure. There is the omega-6s present in our nuts, present in our not only nuts but also I'm sorry, I just starting. I need some healthy omega-3s right now because my brain is. But they're in hemp seed oil and walnut oil and flaxseed oil, all these have a healthy balance of omega-3s and omega-6s both together. I'm not really concerned about some people going too heavy on the omega-3 because that's really rare, especially with the prevalence of omega-6 in our diet today. But I like to steer away from corn oil, but I think we're still going to get it anyways because it's in so much of our processed food, unless you have a very, very pure, purist attitude to your diet. But also, you know, there's healthy omega-6s in evening primrose oil and borage oil, black currant seed oil. We have, you know, definitely, I'm not afraid that we're going to really mess up the ratio by moving more toward omega-3 oils. One thing with omega-3 oils is that you can't really cook with them because they're so flexible and unstable. And so most of the time you want to refrigerate your omega-3 oils and then maybe cook with coconut oil, palm oil, and olive oil in the kitchen.
Yeah, someone asked about red palm oil, what you thought of that.
It's a very similar in its nature to coconut oil, also very highly antioxidant and has some interesting antiviral compounds in there. And so I would think, palm oil is also a really great oil to cook with. And if you get it unrefined, it has this kind of interesting savory flavor. It's in kind of the same way with coconut oil. If you get it unrefined, it has this kind of healthy or this interesting sweet coconutty flavor. And so you want to kind of match it to your meals in that way, you know, making sure that's compatible with the flavor of your dishes and such. But definitely I would support regular use of palm oil in the kitchen as well.
Yeah, this is a comment that I think has an unspoken question in it that says, I thought sea vegetables were the source of omega-3s in fish.
So there are actually supplements out there that that are extracted from vegetarian sources of omega-3s. We definitely, like things like algae is where I would go with that. Not so much, there are definitely plants that have omega-3s, right? And so plants with algae and things like purslane, for instance, that grows in as a weed, and even where I live, purslane is a common succulent weed, very high in omega-3s. There also is things like perilla seed that are high in omega-3s. And so these are the plants that things like chickens and cows might eat that lead to eggs and beef that are higher in omega-3s, and bugs, because bugs also can be high in omega-3s. And then the animals that eat them have more omega-3 in their proteins or, in their tissue. I would definitely venture toward things like algae, like spirulina and things like this in the diet.
If you don't mind me interjecting a comment here, the DHA is not found in plant sources, nor is EPA. The body converts the slightly shorter, the omega-3s that are in plants into DHA and EPA through enzymes, so do animals. But some people might have some problems with conversion and do better with actually getting it from the animal sources.
Absolutely, and this is what I referred to earlier with some people needing to go straight to the...
Yeah.
Because our body has to go a step to convert that.
Yeah, so they may have missed that point there, which is why I wanted to bring it up again. Someone said... Methanol? Did you have methanol or ethanol on a slide?
So one of the slides was referencing a methanol extract, methanol hydraulic extract of lemon balm. And that's just a kind of a common way that some laboratory researchers will obtain an extract from a plant. That obviously is not something I'm going to do in my kitchen. So that was one slide that was referring to a methanol extract, but the other
it's referring to a commercial process, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So that's kind of a commercial way of making that some products are made. But also we have other research like this one that's just a one-to-one tincture. This would be kind of your standard, like your home remedy tincture that you would make, that an herbalist would make at home using alcohol and water to make the tincture. So.
Okay. Someone said, I would love to know lemon balm formula. Would you use this in place of Ritalin?
And so that, you know, the use of Ritalin, I'm losing my slideshow. The use of Ritalin is this, you know, definitely a conversation to have with your practitioner. But I, with people who are pharmaceutical, I have used, and I don't know if you're talking about with children or with elders, but I like to use a tincture of equal parts of Ashwagandha because I think they both synergize really well together. And at least with children, I've had good success just using lemon balm glycerate in equal parts of Ashwagandha tincture. And so you kind of have a little flavor that's not too offensive for children because of the glycerate part of it. Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, because you cut out for a second, so you're talking about giving to children equal parts ashwagandha and lemon balm glycerites?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. All right.
I actually like to use ashwagandha tincture.
Tincture. And lemon balm glycerite.
Yeah. Combined.
Okay. How much rosemary should a person have if they have high blood pressure? Not sure what that was in reference to.
I don't understand the relation between rose. So I don't understand why that question.
I don't understand. I guess the question missed the context for it.
Someone afraid of a potential contraindication? Is that?
I think so.
The issue.
Yeah.
Okay, so rosemary is a culinary herb, and it'd be wonderful to have. Do is smell it, and it's going to elicit a positive cognitive response that boosts memory and mathematical processing. So there's one way to do it, just smell it. But you can also just drink it in tea every day, I don't think there wouldn't be a concern with high blood pressure in drinking rosemary tea every day or tincture. It depends on who the person is. Every herbalist has different dosaging parameters, and I usually do two dropperfuls 2 to 3 times a day of a tincture, of any given tincture, as long as there's no contraindications in that tincture or no low-dose herbs, which rosemary is not one of those. Otherwise, I would do 1 ounce of herb infused over a 3-day period. So just make your batch of house tea using 1 ounce of herbs as a 3-day supply. Make as much water in that tea as you'd like for the next 3 days, and just have that be your everyday refreshment.
Okay. Someone asked about the dosage for Gota Kola and how long it takes to see the effects.
So this is kind of the same answer. As I said with rosemary, if you're doing it depends. Are you doing a tincture, a powder? To me, these are kind of, I'm using them like food. So put your Gota Kola powder in your brain balls or have a little bit every day. I think the important thing is to have a little bit every day. So there are standardized extracts also of Gota Kola on the market, and I would take those as directed on the label. Or because, just working herbally with the person is so different with each person constitutionally, so I would really recommend that you see an herbalist or seek out the advice of an herbalist who's going to do a short intake based on your personal health issues. But with Gota Kola, again, in a tincture, maybe two milliliters 2 to 3 times a day. In tea, the same exact thing, 1 ounce makes a 3-day supply. So you can actually take things like Gota Kola and lemon balm and rosemary and put them all together to make 1 ounce baggies, and those 1 ounce baggies would be your 3-day supply of tea. And so I'm talking about dried herb here.
Okay. There's some really good comments saying how much people enjoyed the webinar. Are the nut balls okay for a 6-year-old? The brain balls, yeah.
yeah, those would be good for the whole family, absolutely.
All right. Is it safe to take turmeric if it has chelating properties while you still have mercury fillings in your mouth?
I'm going to say yes.
I would agree.
It's really healthy for everyone. It's an antioxidant, and if your fillings are chelating, then we need to get that out of the body. So, you know, that's only going to be supportive.
Can too much black pepper hurt a person's liver?
No, I don't think so. I haven't come across that at all. Black pepper is really healthy for the liver and as a circulatory stimulant. The only, and especially in the quantities we're talking about, so the ratio of black pepper to turmeric would be like 1 to 10. So for every measurement of turmeric that you use, 10%, only 5 to 10% should be black pepper. So it's not like we're doing equal parts of black pepper and turmeric. And black pepper does have some ability to make some drugs, pharmaceuticals, more bioavailable to the body, which can be a good thing if you're doing supplements and nutrition. But I would take the black pepper, if you're on pharmaceutical prescription drugs, I would take the black pepper apart from your pharmaceutical drugs, so maybe 2 hours apart at least if you're concerned about this. But honestly, in the small, with this recipe, the black pepper is such a small component that I'm not concerned about it at all. This is almost in the main dish of it all. It's really just it's just a dietary dose of turmeric there, which I'm not concerned about at all.
Okay. People are asking for the amounts in your brain balls, and I think you just were. Do you want to give them some approximations?
Okay, yeah, let's go look at that recipe. I would do, let's say, I know you like recipes. There's so many recipes out there for brain balls.
They could look it up on the internet, or you post one on your website.
Yeah, I mean, I could post one. Basically, you know, I would do like equal parts of coconut oil and nut butter, and then so maybe a cup of each, and then including the oil that's in that nut butter, you know, when you get an organic jar of nut butter. So put the oil in there. We're going to need it because it's going to help hold all the powders. And then with everything else, the gotu kola, the flaxseed, the turmeric, and the ashwagandha powder, let's do equal parts of each one of those. I just gave you the ratio for black pepper to turmeric, so not that much ratio black pepper to turmeric. So you're just even. I just sprinkle black pepper on it. Okay. So then you make a batch of that powder, and then just start stirring that powder in. It's almost like making a pesto. You just got to keep stirring it in until you have your desired consistency. Okay. And so just keep stirring it in until you have the consistency that you can roll, like kind of like clay or Play-Doh, that you can roll it into balls. But then there's lemon balm and rosemary glycerin. It's going to help soften it up a little. Sorry. I don't really have ratios. Honestly, we do this for fun, and we do this in the kitchen. It's all healthy, and it's all food. And I could, next time I make it, I'm just going to measure it just to see what it is, and then I'll put that on there. And I do, when I taught herb school, I have files with recipes in them, so I'm sure I've got this recipe somewhere. I can dig it up. I don't think people should be very concerned about exact measurements here. I think there's this fear that this isn't food or that we want to know exactly what dosage we're getting. And I'm trying to advocate that there's a little bit of all of this in every day. Take your antioxidants. Don't take your antioxidants. Eat and drink your antioxidants a little bit every day. You know, just
Just to save you having to answer a whole bunch of questions, there are a lot of people who are asking questions about dosages and can I use it with prescription medications? You really need, if you've got questions like that, you really need to talk to an herbalist one-on-one because, most of this stuff, it's really safe. I mean, you can use a lot of this stuff the way she's recommending it, just like food. It's not that big of a deal. People tend to think of herbs like drugs, and they think, blah, 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 but like lemon balm and gota cola, I mean, this stuff is practically food. I mean,
everything I talk about today is the body will recognize as food. So everything on here has a long tradition of safety and health-giving reputation. I wouldn't be concerned about dosages with anything I talked about today. I think the important thing is to nourish and quench your body with these foods and these herbs every day. And so make a habit of that. And if you are facing progressive Alzheimer's or serious cognitive decline and you feel better about getting on a measured protocol of addressing your issues, then at that point, I would encourage you to seek out an herbal practitioner. You can go to the American Herbalist Guild website where we have an herbalist directory for professional herbalists. You can look that up in your state and see if there's anyone in your area. And a lot of herbalists also work online or via phone, and I'm one of those herbalists. I work with clinical students, and so all the clients I work with come in through working with roundtables with my students. Feel free to contact me. There's rates and information on my website about, how to sign up for one of those consultations. And my consultations then are very outlined with dosages, and they're very outlined with what kind of extracts and ratios and everything. But this lecture tonight is natural strategies for brain support. It's not really taking a clinical approach. It's taking a home nourishment, lifestyle enhanced, feeding the brain approach is what this is about. But any herbalist will tend to give you a detailed protocol if you seek them out.
Yeah, there's one more general issue I'd like to kind of you and I talk about quickly, and then there's a couple more specific questions if you've got time. Can you handle that? Okay, great. Well, first, a lot of people are asking about issues of like contamination with fish oil and what brand to use and is krill oil okay or whatever. And so do you want to just briefly again just address that whole issue of the oils?
There are issues. And so let me just start by saying the fish oil we get today is not the fish oil that mom used to feed us when we were little kids. Depending on what your age is, but you don't want to have that real terrible fishy smell on your fish oil. But that being said, most of today's fish oil is fairly refined and reputable. There's two products that I refer my clients to, and that's Nordic Naturals and Carlson's. So those are two different products. And the only reason I do that, and I'm not here to promote any products, but those are the two that I've really looked into. And kind of just clear to make sure that they were by reputation, by standard, mercury-free. And so it also helps to have lemon-flavored or orange-flavored. That really helps a lot. And it also helps to take your fish oil before a meal. That way your fish oil is not burping back up, which is a real kind of normal thing. And it's kind of uncomfortable and gross, and people don't like that. But it really helps to just eat your fish oil before a meal and do it that way. Krill oil is also supposed to be a really good form of omega-3s and fish oil, so I would recommend that as well.
And about the burping issue, besides the tip you just gave, if people take the fish oil in gel caps, if you freeze the gel caps and then take them, you won't burp them. Okay.
Okay.
All right.
Is that your tip, Stephen?
That's something I learned from someone else, and it does work. So.
Oh, okay.
Okay. Okay. And someone also said about the conversion of the ALA to DHA and EPA, and are we messing with the body? Ancient people ate lots of foods that contained DHEA and EPA in large quantities, because traditionally people ate a lot of natural wild game and fish and other things in their diet that are high sources of that. So there's no problem with taking that. And if you're vegan, you aren't going to get EPA or DHA in any plant source. So if you don't, if you're showing signs of not being able to convert it, then take a supplement. But I don't know how else to do it. Okay, now the questions, the specific ones. If I can find them here. Someone said, I tend towards folk medicine more than standard extracts. What is there an estimated dosage like to get it just as an herb for ginkgo? I mean, have you used ginkgo as not a standardized extract? Start that over because you dropped out.
So tincture in my brain. I said yes. I've used ginkgo in formulas as a tincture for brain boost and brain health. That being said, all I'm pointing out is that the research is all based on ginkgo biloba extract, which is much more concentrated and almost a different product than ginkgo leaf tea itself, you know? And so if you are not, like, there are people who just don't want to take supplements or encapsulated products or any kind of processed, you know, formula. So in that case, by all means, do the ginkgo biloba in tea or tincture or in kitchen remedy. But then let us know anecdotally, because, you know, all that we know so far is based on the research that is all conducted on ginkgo biloba extract. And so it's going to, depending on what your body is and you know, how some people respond to very subtle medicine, and that might be what you're saying, you know, that you're adverse to taking supplements and pharmaceuticals and things like this, and it might be that you just already naturally respond to the subtlety, and so you might have a better response to ginkgo biloba in a tea. But also, it's a very affordable extract and a very with demonstrated clinical effects research-wise. And so I will regularly, it's one of the very few, I hardly ever work with standardized extracts, but there's a handful that I will work with that have already a lot of evidence in the research. And so ginkgo biloba is one of those handful of standardized extracts that I will recommend. But that being said, there's no traditional evidence for ginkgo, unless someone points it out to me, there's no traditional evidence for ginkgo for brain health and brain. The traditional evidence of ginkgo points toward heart health and lung health, which is the traditional ways that in traditional Chinese medicine people were taking ginkgo biloba, but that's distinct from the way that ginkgo biloba, we would say, is that this is evidence extrapolated from pharmacological understanding rather than evidence extrapolated from traditional knowing. And so I'm always actively seeking out where the evidence is coming from. And so that's just something to consider with, you know, your own personal choices of how you want to take your herbs.
Okay. And someone asked again about the snowdrop. And you mentioned the bulb is toxic, so you don't use that. How about, is it okay for the people to use the flower?
Yeah, so folk herbalists from European traditions will use the flower and the aerial parts, and the flowers if they're in flower, but they're using making a tea from.
Okay.
Is what they're not using the bulb. So.
Well, I think we've answered most of the really important questions. If we didn't get to your question, we're sorry, but we are a bit over our time already, and we don't want to take too advantage of Mimi here. Mimi, thank you very much for doing this webinar tonight. A lot of really great information, and thanks to all of you for joining us. So,
thank you, Stephen, and thank you to everyone else. This will be available as a recording, so if you want to revisit or go share it with your friends or other people you think would be interested, this will be available. So, good night.
Good night.